4 years before Thomas was arrested, for instance, a man named Jules Lowe was found not guilty of murdering his 83-year-old father after claiming that the attack occurred during a sleep terror. Prosecutors argued it was far-fetched in the extreme to believe that Lowe was asleep while he punched, kicked, and stamped his father for more than 20 minutes, leaving him with over 90 injuries. The jury disagreed and set him free. In September 2008, 33-year-old Donna Shepherd Saunders nearly suffocated her mother by holding a pillow over her face for 30 seconds. She was later acquitted of attempted murder by arguing that she had acted while asleep. In 2009, a British soldier admitted to raping a teenage girl, but said he was asleep and unconscious while he undressed himself, pulled down her pants, and began having sex. When he woke mid-rape, he apologized and called the police. "I've just sort of committed a crime," he told the emergency operator. "I honestly don't know what happened. I woke up on top of her." He had a history of suffering from sleep terrors and was found not guilty. More than 150 murderers and rapists have escaped punishment in the past century using the automatism defense. Judges and juries, acting on behalf of society, have said that since the criminals didn't choose to commit their crimes, since they didn't consciously participate in the violence, they shouldn't bear the blame. For Brian Thomas, it also looked like a situation where a sleep disorder, rather than a murderous impulse, was at fault. "I'll never forgive myself. Ever," he told one of the prosecutors. "Why did I do it?" After Dr. Idzikowski, the sleep specialist, observed Thomas in his laboratory, he submitted his findings. Thomas was asleep when he killed his wife. He hadn't consciously committed a crime. As the trial started, prosecutors presented their evidence to the jury. Thomas had admitted to murdering his wife, they told jurors. He knew he had a history of sleepwalking. His failure to take precautions while on vacation, they said, made him responsible for his crime. But as arguments proceeded, it became clear prosecutors were fighting an uphill battle. Thomas's lawyer argued that his client hadn't meant to kill his wife. In fact, he wasn't even in control of his own actions that night. Instead, he was reacting automatically to a perceived threat. He was following a habit almost as old as our species, the instinct to fight an attacker and protect a loved one. Once the most primitive parts of his brain were exposed to a cue, someone strangling his wife, his habit took over and he fought back, with no chance of his higher cognition interceding. Thomas was guilty of nothing more than being human, the lawyer argued, and reacting in the way his neurology and most primitive habits forced him to behave. Even the prosecution's own witnesses seemed to bolster the defense. Though Thomas had known he was capable of sleepwalking, the prosecution's own psychiatrist said there was nothing to suggest to him that it was therefore foreseeable he might kill. He had never attacked anyone in his sleep before. He had never previously harmed his wife. When the prosecution's chief psychiatrist took the stand, Thomas's lawyer began his cross-examination. "Did it seem fair that Thomas should be found guilty for an act he could not know was going to occur?" In her opinion, said Dr. Caroline Jacob, Thomas could not have reasonably anticipated his crime. And if he was convicted and sentenced to Broadmoor Hospital, where some of Britain's most dangerous and mentally ill criminals were housed, well, he does not belong there. The next morning, the head prosecutor addressed the jury. At the time of the killing, the defendant was asleep, and his mind had no control over what his body was doing, he said. "We have reached the conclusion that the public interest would no longer be served by continuing to seek a special verdict from you. We therefore offer no further evidence and invite you to return a straight, not guilty verdict. The jury did so. Before Thomas was set free, the judge told him, "You are a decent man and a devoted husband. I strongly suspect you may well be feeling a sense of guilt. In the eyes of the law, you bear no responsibility. You are discharged." It seems like a fair outcome. After all, Thomas was obviously devastated by his crime. He had no idea what he was doing when he acted. He was simply following a habit, and his capacity for decision-making was, in effect, incapacitated. Thomas is the most sympathetic murderer conceivable, someone so close to being a victim himself that when the trial ended, the judge tried to console him. Yet many of those same excuses can be made for Angie Bachman, the gambler. She was also devastated by her actions. She would later say she carries a deep sense of guilt. And as it turns out, she was also following deeply ingrained habits that made it increasingly difficult for decision-making to intervene. But in the eyes of the law, Bachman is responsible for her habits, and Thomas isn't. Is it right that Bachman, a gambler, is guiltier than Thomas, a murderer? What does that tell us about the ethics of habit and choice?